Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the Matt and Shaheen podcast. Today, we've got part 2 of our interview with David Breer of 11FS. Let's dive straight in.
So one of those industries that is well on the way to change, although just slightly at the moment, is obviously banking. Now, challenger banks is something that both G and I are really passionate about. We absolutely love them.
Yeah, I love your t-shirt, dude.
Yeah, Zerocon memorabilia, right?
Nice.
So just like really interested to get your thoughts on how do we get to this point and what were the opportunities that presented themselves to these challenger banks to take the opportunity?
Yeah, do you know what? It's been a really, really interesting one. And we're actually sort of embarking on a project right now, but it's 11 years since the financial crisis. Which is crazy, right?
That's insane. I feel old.
I know. All right. It's like it is just terrifying because I remember, and it's a strange one because it's like I think you guys are younger than me, but like it's like our generation's version of like where were you when? You when with the financial crisis?
Yeah.
And like the really shitty thing was like I was joining a bank. So I just joined a bank, and like 6 months later, the financial crisis hit. So I was just sat there at my desk going, should have just stayed in insurance, shouldn't I? You know, this would have been fine. But like what's happened since then has just been a series of change, like very purposeful chess move style stuff that have led to us really having like the greatest ecosystem for financial services that I think there is. You know, to the point that actually we're having, you know, Hong Kong and Singapore and the US and, you know, Abu Dhabi and all these people trying to replicate what we've done from a regulatory perspective, from an ecosystem perspective. I know ecosystem's been like played out as a word and people don't like it, but genuinely like the London and broader UK ecosystem for financial services is just insane.
Yeah.
Like in London alone, we've got, you know, the US has always held up as such a kind of a pillar, but you know, in London, you've got like our version of Silicon Valley, you've got our version of New York, you know, with the financial capability, the financial might that's there, you know, our version of Washington with everything that actually happens in either in Parliament or from a regulatory perspective. And you've got all of these things in such close proximity. And if you throw in like crazy talented people, you throw in the like an absolute flurry of investment that kind of came through with various different people, we've just had the kind of perfect storm for creating all of these new waves of financial services companies. So like say whether it's, you know, a Tide or a Monzo or whoever, and if you kind of throw into the mix a real negativity around big banks at the time, like say if you go back to 2008, then actually, you know, literally, I remember a period where it's like, you get into the back of a taxi and people are like, so what do you do, mate? And I'm like, I work in IT, because I didn't want to tell them that I worked at a bank, you know what I mean? So like the move away from big banks to being like a, you know, safe pair of, you know, where to work for the rest of your life to being like the scourge of like the worst people, you know, has kind of led to, you know, people like Starling, people like Monzo, being able to create brands that people like trust. Because I think fundamentally the trust has gone in banking. Like I think people trust them not to like run away with their money, but they don't trust them to do the things that are right for them. And that's the difficulty thing, you know, and actually once that trust is actually gone, really hard to get back. And these new players coming through have created, you know, it's not just like a fancy app and like a lovely hot coral card. You know, this really is about something that people believe in. And if you believe in that brand and you believe that brand is there, you know, they're super trustworthy, they're displaying that they've got your interests at heart in terms of kind of what they're doing, people really get behind it. And not only get behind it, they like tell all their friends, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I've got my mom on a Monzo card because like, you know, I believe in that brand and she finds it easier to use than the HSBC account that she had for like 25 years. And it's not because it's like, it's doing anything different. Do you know what I mean? It's still a piece of plastic that she kind of carries around and stuff. But actually just the way that they talk to people, the capability that they deploy is so much simpler that given this thing or this thing, you would always go for that, you know?
Yeah.
And it's crazy. It's simple user experience things, but also just talking to humans like humans. I think the banking industry and big, you know, big incumbent organizations have got so much to feeling paranoia around the next mis-selling thing or the next thing they're going to be hit with, that they kind of forget that at the end of these things, you know, there are like human beings like using your services. I would say it's like actually, look, if you sent an email to a friend with the same sort of tone that a bank sent it to you, they'd think you were like not friends with them anymore. You know what I mean? So it's like how can they bring back that human interaction with customers, because it's definitely gone now.
It's just the approach, the transparency, the culture, all of that comes through in their communication, I think, with most challenger banks. I'm interested to know what the future of challenger banks actually looks like on just on that topic. Like, the majority of them are all doing the right things. They're saying the right things. They're attracting, you know, a customer base that, like you said, trusts them. How does a challenger bank kind of, well, firstly, how does the landscape look in the next kind of 5 years? And how does a challenger bank differentiate themselves from each other, I guess? It's not just about a hot coral card, is it, right?
So. I mean, it's not just that. It doesn't hurt, does it?
Yeah,
but
of course.
So I think, like, honestly, I think slices of business are going to go and go and go. Like, this isn't a trend that's done. It's just, I think retail banking is probably saturated enough now where there's not going to be many more players come through in the UK market that can gain market share. You know, ultimately, there's only so many customers that to go around, right? So, but within the business sense, we're definitely seeing kind of more and more people coming through. And with these other slices of business, more and more will come as well. I kind of think we're in a situation where, you know, many of the companies that have started in with different beachheads, essentially. You know, Revolut started in the kind of traveler, you know, best way to spend money type category. And they've sort of pivoted into more and more things as they've been successful. You know, similarly, you know, Monzo started in one space doing a prepaid card. They're now doing, you know, through partnerships, they're doing savings. They've made, you know, announcements about doing all sorts of stuff in the lending space as well. Starling as well. You know, Starling started with a retail current account. They've now got a business account. They do bank as a service. You know, they're kind of pulling all of these things out, really. But if I'm honest with you, I think people have got pretty short memories. Like, no bank kind of started with, like, 15 different divisions and 500 products. You know, they, like, Nationwide, as a really good example, started with just doing mortgages and did it for, like, one village in the middle of, I don't know, West somewhere. so, you know, like, they did that really well. And the success of that allowed them to do more and more and more because, well, you know, if you've got some more money, you can invest it in doing more things. So I think the challenge is space. You know, TransferWise started doing transfers, you know, now they're doing current accounts and all other stuff. So I kind of see more and more of these organizations taking the success that they've had and the trust that they've sort of nurtured, the brand that they've got, and kind of doing more and more things with it. You know, the whole kind of marketplace banking, you know, I know Tom Blomfield and Anne Bowden particularly are really sort of passionate about what that will bring. But for me, I think it's going to be a fascinating one. I think, if I'm honest with you, I think the most interesting thing, I think those guys are going to be more and more and more successful. You know, if you look at the amount of money that they've got now to invest to continue developing the products and, you know, spending more money on marketing and bringing in more customers, they're going to get bigger and bigger. But I always say it's like actually the impact that they've had already is now, you know, ridiculous. Like if you look at Monzo particularly, they've acquired more customers in 3 years than First Direct did in 30, which is crazy. You know, First Direct was created in 1989, which is mental. Like, you know, like if we felt old about the financial crisis, like now we really feel it. You know what I mean? So, but yeah, I just want to say, like, I think I was like 8 at the time then. So like you guys were probably younger at that point, right?
Yeah, I was born in 1990.
Dude, so you were so you're younger than First Direct.
First Direct, correct? Yeah,
that's crazy.
And I'm a Monzo customer. That means something in the scheme of things here.
But I think you know if you look there, these guys are kind of like rewriting a bunch of this stuff, right? So you know, First Direct was held up as the pillar of customer service and NPS, and you know, like cheeky chappy Northerners will always pick up the phone and that type of stuff. Whereas actually, like the you know, the NPS scoring that people like Monzo are now getting is like just off the charts for those things. So I just think we're seeing a kind of a redefining of what good looks like, and that'll only continue to happen. The interesting thing is going to be like, how does the empire strike back? You know, how do the big banks kind of take back some of that market share? Because the only way they're going to do it is by massively changing the cost structuring whether in their organizations or flipping to suddenly really doing all the stuff that they say that they do in their marketing. And that's the hard thing. It's almost like the brands that people like Monzo and Starling and you know Revolut and whatnot have delivered is doing something amazing and getting other people to do your marketing for you. And not in like, you know, we're so fancy we don't do marketing. In a, we do something so good that people like it. which just shouldn't be a differentiator. Do you know what I mean? Like, you shouldn't, it shouldn't be a differentiation in the market where it's like, well, the only brand of like water I like is the one that doesn't taste like crap type thing. It's like, no, it just shouldn't do that. And now I'd like vitamins in it or something. I don't know. So I kind of think the big incumbent organizations are going to have to really sort of get their act together, because there's no longer the, hey, we're marketing as like, we're here for you and it's all going to be wonderful, but then smacking you with like a big, you know, a fee for going overdrawn, or, you know, flipping you onto like a 0.1% savings rate when you weren't looking or something, you know what I mean? So, and these types of things is why people just don't trust banks anymore.
Yeah. I get that all the time. Every time I tell people about, oh, you got to get onto this Monzo, you got to get into the Starling, they just ask me what's so special about it. And the answer is it just works. Like, it just works. There's nothing wrong with it. You know, like with every one of your other bank accounts, you can probably tell me that there's something wrong with it.
Yeah.
There's just absolutely nothing wrong with any of them.
Do you know, the strange thing, we sort of say, like, digital transformation in big organizations has led to basically the commoditization of the service. And it wasn't always like that. Like, if you went back to the good old days, as it were, in terms of, you know, branch banking, where like people kind of knew you and like knew your family or your kids or your wife or whatever type thing, like actually that sort of human experience was like a real differentiator, because like you wouldn't get a loan based on like what the computer said, you'd get it based on like how good you were for it and based on how they knew your family and blah 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 blah. So like there was a lot more kind of like human stuff in there. Bizarrely, like hundreds of billions of pounds spent has just sort of commoditized that experience to the point where everybody just gets this generic banking experience. And I think the great thing with Monzo actually is it feels, although it's a truly sort of digital bank, it feels more human than any bank that I've kind of come across.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting to see how they scale that. You know, how do you bring about, you know, some other people kind of understanding or caring about that? Because it's it's stupid stuff. It's like using emojis in their customer service stuff, because, well, that's how humans talk to humans. You know, it's not all kind of, dear sir or madam, we are terribly sorry about the outage that we, you know, like, it's like, look, this has happened, we're sorry about it, this is what we're doing, you know, transparency and keeping you in touch with where you're at. So it's bizarrely like the small things. But like, you know, you go to a big bank and go, yeah, we're going to use emojis to kind of send out messages and emails. They're like, well, our brand team are going to freak the hell out right
What's
now.
What's an emoji?
Exactly. Yeah. Some of them for sure. Yeah. So it is surprisingly the small things, but very often the small things are a lot harder to fix.
Yeah. So there's going to be a tipping point with these challenger banks. So when does a challenger stop becoming a challenger?
I think that's interesting. That's why
we asked the question.
Do you know, I've been kind of worrying about that a little bit with some of the ones that we've got in the UK right now. Just because actually you can start to see, you know, if in a world where like the differentiator for success is like talent and culture, right? At the point where actually, you know, talent is finite, right? There can only be so many talented people kind of working around the industry doing various different things, and only so many of those really talented people can like care enough to really like bust a gut to kind of make this type of stuff happen. Then you will, you know, somebody somewhere has like not the talented people who don't care, right? Which is worrying, because then they just become corporates. And that's terrifying, because then you, to my point earlier on, like the soul of something like a Monzo for me is what really differentiates it from, you know, the incumbent players. And if they lose that soul, if they lose that culture, then, you know, actually, are they going to be able to continually push forwards, you know? Because there, if you kind of look, there's going to be a bunch of people who have been at Monzo or been at Starling or, you know, Revolut or whatever, that actually the maturity on even just the equity that those guys will have got from being founding partners will probably be running its course around about now. And I do wonder over the next like year or two whether we're going to start to see a bit of a slowdown in the innovation side of things in terms of what those players are actually doing. But also I wonder whether with the new people that come in after the founders just don't care as much. So it's going to be fascinating to kind of see. I hope they kind of keep it, but it's, you know, it's the major inhibitor from the corporates is culture.
Yeah.
It's the major benefit that the startups have right now, and they need to kind of keep it alive as long as they can. It's a real fine balancing act, if I'm honest with you. And we've kind of faced this as well. It's like the balancing act between being like super nimble and scrappy and focusing everybody on the main goal, or having scale and having process and having structure and governance. Banks sometimes go way too far the other way, where actually the whole organization is there to stop stuff happening rather than make stuff happen. And startups definitely go the wrong way sometimes, where it's all about making stuff happen and not enough about structure and governance.
Yeah. And as a customer, sometimes you get that sense as well. In your interactions with the bank, you just feel like, you're just making this so difficult for me. Every step is a blocker.
Yeah.
And then with some startups, you just feel like, wow, that was very easy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, like, big banks are an exercise in like mergers and acquisitions over the last like 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. So like if you're unlucky enough to have like a retail account and a business account with them, you might as well be like two separate people, because it's going to be two separate systems. Like literally two separate people can access those systems. And there's one bank organization that we know now that has, it's like 45 different back-end systems that, wow, if you call in their telephony system, that they actually have to go through. And I'm like, I don't know how people even That's remember crazy. Those passwords. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so it's just crazy the things that those poor people on the phone sometimes have to do to just leap through all of those hoops to serve you. But while they're doing that, while they're worrying about like, well, was that an exclamation mark at the end of this passport or whatever type thing, they're not focusing on the stuff to actually make your experience better. And that's really the point. They're hamstringing the people because they can't get their shit together with their technology, basically.
Mm. I'm interested to know, like, just on that point, actually, with talking about the startups versus the big banks, like, going into kind of the day-to-day of 11FS and the work that you guys do, what are the key objections that you get from banks? What holds them back from engaging with you or taking on projects successfully?
I think banks have been slightly sort of Stockholm syndrome-y, if I'm honest with you. I think they expect everything, bizarrely, they expect everything to require hundreds of people and take millions of pounds. So actually, like, the hardest thing that we have to convince people of is usually like, guys, this isn't as hard as you think it is, and actually it shouldn't cost as much and take as long, which is like, it's a nice problem to have, right? It feels like, oh no, my beautiful like jelly's too sweet, it's like, oh, woe is me. But I think it's like one of those things where people have been kind of wedded for so long to doing things in a certain way that actually proving to them that it can be done in a different way is almost like magic. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're in a situation where you can, with Foundry, what we're trying to do is, like, we can spin up a brand new instance of a bank in 11 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, most people do that in, like, 18 months. So when we say we can do it in 11 minutes, people don't believe us until we do it, and then they're like, shit. So it's like, that type of thing we've had a lot. It's kind of weird. We had a lot of, you can't, like, spin up a bank and, go and buy a thing in, years in what we did with Metal, but in, I think it was just under 11 weeks, we managed to create a new instance with a new card, with a new app, and go and buy the CEO a mince pie, just to kind of prove that we could, because if you do it differently and you have different levels of expectations in terms of what you're going to achieve, then you kind of make it happen, really. Mm. What we're trying to do really is, like, how do you take startup mentalities and methodologies? Like, how do you bring the stuff that the fintechs are actually doing, but apply it to, like, whole-scale global organizations? Because they've got bigger customer bases and more money to invest doesn't mean, everything should be required more money to invest. Do you know what I mean? It's like that idea that every time you go to a venue and go, I'm putting on my wedding, it costs like 500 times more than it would do if you were just putting on a birthday party. It's because they can. Well, we don't think people should just do because they can.
Yeah, awesome. So something we come across a lot is lack of urgency from firms, from partners, from businesses in general. Do you have any particular strategies for creating urgency and perhaps ringing alarm bells for clients?
I mean, shouting a lot.
Yeah,
I find that.
We find that as well, actually.
Scare tactics work. Yeah. I think it's it really depends on the client. Mm. Very, very different people are at very different sort of levels of maturity when it comes to kind of what they need. Like, some know exactly what they need to do, but actually it's not really about the idea. It's about execution. You know, in most instances, you know, generally we find, you know, most bank CEOs, if you stand back far enough, go, well, you can't really fault any of their logic. You know, you kind of fault the decisions that they're actually making. But if you look at the sort of middle management in many of those organizations, they're predominantly sort of protecting the thing that they do and the thing that they're good at, which, you know, if you're a branch banking guy and you've always been a branch banking guy and you always intend on being a branch banking guy, then this funny internet stuff is never going to catch on, right? So I kind of think the need for people to kind of come in and just like repeatedly ask why, which, if I'm honest with you, like my mom would tell you, has like been my worst trait since I was like 4 years old type thing. But just coming in and asking like dumb questions and going, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why? I think that kind of helps people to kind of reevaluate stuff. I think it's really interesting when you, like us at 11FS, we've been in such a, like say, hyper growth sense. We kind of don't know what steady state sort of feels like. But I kind of feel like when you get to a point where you're in steady state, then regaining that momentum for change is always really, really difficult. And I think the big banks have kind of got them into self into a place where actually they've sort of ossified around protectionism protectionism of themselves and process that's secure. And you kind of find this in many sort of SMEs as well. You know, SMEs will scale to a certain degree and then get to a point where they're making a good amount of money. They're confident in what they do. Their whole supply chain is working well. That, you know, they're very comfortable, but almost like creating and defining that next leap of, well, what's the thing that will create growth around your organization or your industry, and how will that materially help you and your business move forward? Well, you know, again, it's an exercise in risk mitigation in terms of, is the opportunity great enough for sort of taking the risk?
I mean, to quote Gary Vee here, right? It's better to put yourself out of business than for somebody else to do it for you. And I never really understood what that meant until I like really sat on it and thought about it. Because like he comes out with that quite a lot. Like, you know, put yourself out of business.
Do you know what? Bizarrely, the person who I heard that first from wasn't Gary Vee, but it was actually Alison Rose from RBS. No. So bizarrely, that's her whole thing. She's like, well, like, do we wait for a bunch of players to kind of come in and like slice by slice disrupt everything that we're doing, or do we do it to ourselves? I mean, like, Gary's a smart guy, but I heard that first from Alison, so
I'll trust your judgment on that one. Yeah, for sure. I know
those two know each other as well, so maybe he stole it from her.
could be. Last one for me. I mean, just kind of a fun one. Our listeners are accountants and bookkeepers. So in terms of your accountant, what's the one thing you wish your accountant could do better?
Do you know what? I think the thing that we were kind of looking for most, and again, it's like we've gone through like a rapid amount of sort of change. So yeah. If I'm honest with you, like the basics of accounting, you know, people always get really, really well, you know, like the ensuring returns are done and the sort of formulaic stuff. I think as you're sort of growing and scaling a business, it's the strategic stuff. It's like actually having the data to your fingertips to make the decisions that make you more nervous. And almost to your point around the in the business or on the business, well, you don't want to spend, you know, a week of your time trying to pull together the data to be able to make the decision. You want to make the decision and make most of the opportunity, because in some instances, your ability to wait a week to make a strategic decision for your business, which may or may not mean millions of pounds of revenue for your business or not, you know, you kind of can't wait. So for me, I think, you know, from an accounting side of things, this is decision making. You know, how can you create the insights, the information that allow the people who work with you and their businesses to just make smarter decisions?
Yeah. And I guess to end it, do you have any questions for us? Anything you wanted to bring up? I mean, we've just been asking you a bunch of things.
I mean, I think we're good. I think we've gone a long way there, haven't we? But like, we've covered a lot of ground here. Like, we need to maybe put a couple more industries to rights at this point. I'm good for now. Thanks.
That's awesome. That's perfect. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. I guess if people, listeners, want to reach out to you, what's the best way for getting in contact with you?
Yeah, you can find me Twitter. Just hit me up on David Breer. That's B-R-E-A-R. If you want to email me, feel free, david@11fs.com. Or if you want to just find out about what we do, hit us on 11fs.com.
Awesome. Thanks, dude. Really appreciate it.
No problem at all.
Cheers.
All right, there we have it. Thanks again for the 11FS team for hosting us. We had an awesome time. What a great experience. We hope you found that super interesting, super insightful. There was so much good stuff in there, wasn't there, Shane?
It was brilliant. Like, just the depth of conversation we had was just brilliant. I think there's a lot of, although obviously 11FS are not in the accounting space, I think there's a lot that accounting partners can take. It kind of fits in that mold of, like, you've got your, what can we do as a practice, but then step back and say, what can we do as a business? Making an impact, how can we kind of future-proof the business, how can we continue to price well, how can we continue to beat out the competition. Man, we should do more field trips.
Yeah, let's get something in the diary now.
Absolutely. No, we really, really should. And thank you to our listeners, obviously, for being patient. Obviously, our first two-parter.
Yeah.
Right?
That's growth. Next episode's episode 10, Shaheen. Our baby's growing up.
Our baby's all grown up. Double digits.
That's insane, man. Can't wait for it. So yeah, where can our lovely listeners find you?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter as usual at Shaheen Boudrani. Tweet me there. It'll be good. What about yourself, Matt?
Likewise, Twitter at Matt Lucas Tweets. So yeah, feel free to reach out. Happy to connect with anyone. That's what Definitely. It's all about.
And guys, we'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the podcast on any of the platforms that you use to listen to this. If you could leave us a review, that'd be super, super handy. You know, we're a small, scrappy podcast trying to make our way in the world of podcasting. So yeah, any reviews, any subscribes, that would really, really be handy. And thank you guys so much. And we'll see you all in episode 10.
Awesome. See you there.